From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Racism rears its head in many ugly ways, sometimes aggressively so.
This morning, police in northeastern Iowa are investigating what they believe is a hate crime after finding two burnt crosses.
Sometimes more subtly.
Even though the laws have changed, banks like Associated in 2015 are still getting busted for turning down Black and Latino applicants in disproportionate numbers. When on paper, they're exactly as qualified as white applicants.
That's coming up. First, though, let's get your thoughts on some of last week's conversations. We listened back to some of our favorite shows. One was about the biological differences between men and women and whether there is a superior gender after all. Here are your first thoughts.
This is Gordon Stelter calling from Athens, Georgia. I think what we need to do is get rid of the idea that there is anything by any criteria that can be called superior. And even if there were, why on earth would that be a just cause for one set of people to oppress another? For that matter, one species to oppress another. There is no such thing as superior. All of the earth should be considered equal, and no oppression of any sort should be countenanced.
We also revisited some of our best segments with CDC experts. One of those included a discussion about smoking rights here in Georgia, and we got this call about the very real dangers of secondhand smoke.
My name is Marisa Harvey. I'm a physical therapist that works in home health, and we go to patients' homes that smoke. Patients have the right to smoke in their home, and we're supposed to respect that right. However, I don't want to be exposed to secondhand smoke either.
We always love to hear what you think, so you can call us at 404-500-9457. Leave a message like Gordon and Marisa did. We're also on Twitter, at OST Talk, or post to Facebook, and remember, we might feature your comments on the show. If you happen to work and live along a MARTA line, you're one of the lucky ones who can, if you want to, avoid daily traffic. And many homeowners pay a premium to live in an area with convenient access to public transportation. But that access does not always translate into increased home values. A recent study from the consulting firm Booz Allen Hamilton shows a disparate correlation between proximity to MARTA and home prices. Prices went up on the south side of the city, but homes close to MARTA lost value in the north. Joining us now by phone is Derek Duckworth. He's owner of the Beltline Team Real Estate Company. Hi, Derek.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you so much for joining us. And Joseph Crispina joins us as well. He's a professor of history at Emory University. Hi, Joseph.
Good morning.
Derek, first of all, there's a difference between the MARTA line and the Beltline. Why do we correlate those two things?
Well, so the MARTA is in existence today, right? So the MARTA follows commercial node north and south and east and west, and the Beltline circles downtown Atlanta and is a project that should be completed in the next 10 to 15 years.
But the Beltline intersects MARTA, meaning that you could feasibly live on the Beltline and get to MARTA without a car.
Exactly. It should actually make the MARTA system a more fluent system, so it's easier to get not only from neighborhoods, but also the commercial nodes that people of interest would have around town.
So when we see this study from Booz Allen Hamilton that says that some homes are losing value when they're close to the MARTA line and some are growing up, the prices are going up, how dramatic is that? Is that significant in us for us to draw some conclusions?
I don't think so, because I want to say that in Atlanta, you know, we're still the South. We're still a little different than other cities, but people are starting to take on the transit a little bit more. So even if it might be decreasing in value, it's pretty minimal right now. But I believe going forward, more and more people will be closer to transit as long as traffic, you know, traffic's now a 7-day-a-week issue in Atlanta. So, yeah, I think those values should increase over time.
Okay, we'll see if that happens. But Joseph, in the meantime, there is some historical precedent in Atlanta and pretty much any major city that sort of dictate artificially home values. Is that fair? I mean, in other words, there the home values in some communities will go up and not in others, and that's not always necessarily tied to their location or the quality of the home.
Yes. And I mean, historically, there have been all kinds of factors that have affected the development of various neighborhoods, federal policies, state policies, you know, private policies of of individual lenders and real estate agents and all the rest.
What is the history when we start talking about the south side of Atlanta and the north side of Atlanta? Historically, what do we see in terms of home values there, and what influenced that?
Well, these are areas of the city that have developed very differently for a mix of historical reasons. You know, throughout the history of real estate in urban areas, you know, real estate has been affected by policies that have been set by the federal government that make available the kind of credit and loans that you need to live in certain neighborhoods. And historically, what we've seen is a practice in which minority neighborhoods and many inner city neighborhoods have not gotten access to the credit they need to develop a real estate market there, a vibrant real estate market, and small businesses and the rest.
Help me understand what you mean when you're talking about the credit that they need. Are you talking just about government-backed loans?
I'm talking about a process called that's oftentimes referred to as redlining. This developed out of the 1930s, out of the Federal Housing Administration that was established there to try to, basically, it set up what is the modern real estate market. It created, you know, the basic fundamentals that we think about, the 30-year fixed loan, building codes, all the rest. Part of what they did as well is they created these maps of various cities around the country, and they would rate the different parts of the cities, and they would rate them in terms of the real estate values and the security of the loans being given there. Because what the federal government was doing was ensuring loans that were given out by private lenders. And so it was trying to make sure that the loans that were being given out were going to be repaid. But in the process, what they would do is they would rate areas that were, say, where African Americans lived or that were near industry. They would be rated as insecure places to give out loans. And therefore, they would not be given the same kinds of access to credit. And they actually created these maps where those areas where you were not to give out loans were colored in red. And that's where this term redlining comes from.
So when that kind of brings us back to you, Derek, because let's fast forward. When you see this study from Booz Allen Hamilton, which shows prices going up in the south part of the city, which is often been known as largely African American, and going down in the north side of the city when they're closer to MARTA, what conclusions do you draw, and especially in terms of the historic racial separation of the city?
Well, so the whole redlining effect probably started a snowball effect, which also had infrastructure and city investments probably dwindle a little bit, which probably helped the neighborhoods to be somewhat undervalued. And developments always kind of happen north of 20. So I'd say that the reason why the values are going up today is because there hasn't been so much investment in over the years, and now there's nothing but a chance to start investing in these neighborhoods.
So perhaps the homes in the south side are just have more room to go up.
They definitely have more room to go up. Actually, a lot of the neighborhoods were developed by the same developers that developed on the north side. So as people have been buying north and infrastructure has always been better on the north side, you're finding some of the same housing stock south of the city.
My guests are real estate agent Derek Duckworth and Emory University historian Joseph Crispino. So, Joseph, let's also modernize this idea of redlining. When and did it ever change? Because when you talk about redlining, that also includes insurance companies that may insure your home against damage, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the practice of redlining was identified and drawn out, and community activists were working on it in the 1960s and 70s, federal law changes in 1968. In 1970, but many of these practices are carried out at the private level, and they continue since the 1970s. So they're very hard to root out always. It should be said also that even we talk about the division between North Atlanta and South Atlanta, this was, you know, we oftentimes put it at I-20.
Yeah.
I-20 was drawn exactly to kind of to delineate between what were historically black neighborhoods and what were historically white neighborhoods.
Wait, when they decided where I-20 was going to run,
yeah,
from east to west or west to east, they used that as a dividing line?
Well, it was oftentimes used as a way to create barriers between neighborhoods that were historically white and historically black. Yeah, I mean, historians have shown this in And Kevin Cruz, a great historian at Princeton University, in his book White Flight, talks about the Bend and I-20 on the east side of town was oftentimes used to was considered at the time thought to be used as a barrier between, you know, these historically white and black neighborhoods.
And again, when an insurance company redlines, meaning they charge more for insurance in one community as opposed to another community, even if the actuarial tables show them being relatively the same. That means if my house in the south side of Atlanta gets damaged, I may not have the coverage to fix it, whereas if that same house was in the north side of Atlanta, I would be covered. Is that fairly accurate?
I suppose so. I'm not really an expert on those kinds of issues, but yeah, it sounds reasonable.
I mean, I'm just trying to draw the historical line and how one neighborhood, as the decades go by, may have a completely different outcome because of federal loan guarantees and because of redlining and insurance. And, you know, four decades later, look very different than the same neighborhood that maybe was built by the same developer.
Well, there's no doubt that there's a legacy of these older patterns of discrimination that we still see in our landscape today in Atlanta.
So then that brings us to attitudes toward the MARTA, because if homes close to MARTA in the north are losing value, how is that related to people's attitudes toward public transportation on the north side of Atlanta?
Well, we've seen historically in the history of MARTA that there, you know, some people see MARTA as a great resource, a way to avoid traffic, a way to get people around the area. Other people have historically seen MARTA as a way to bring in unwanted people into their neighborhood. So, you know, there are reasons why MARTA doesn't run into Cobb County. When MARTA was being proposed and the debates about where MARTA would run were happening, voters in Cobb County didn't want MARTA in their neighborhood. And if you go back and look at those debates, a lot of the debate and a lot of the public talk about it was this thought that if we have MARTA coming into our neighborhood, it's going to bring undesirables into our neighborhood.
So, Derek, is there a difference in attitude, do you see, between customers in terms of homes that they want that are near the Beltline as opposed to homes that are near MARTA? Is the Beltline more desirable to be close to than MARTA?
Well, it definitely is. Well, that's more based on what people believe the MARTA system is. So I think he's right in the fact that people haven't always embraced MARTA, and a new transit line might make sense a little bit more to people. But I'd also say that millennials are a whole lot different than the normal people that have been buying in the city for a long time. Millennials are a little bit more open. The neighborhoods are much more diverse today, and it's actually appreciated, where I don't think it was when MARTA was first introduced. I don't think it was appreciated at all.
We've got about 30 seconds left, Derek. Are millennials buying homes?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I'd say that half my client base right now are millennials. And I focus especially around transit, MARTA, and the Beltline. So, yeah, I'd say that majority of my buyers are millennials.
So perhaps the history going forward, Joe, is going to be different than the history in the past. That is Derek Duckworth. He is owner of the Beltline Team Real Estate Company. And Joseph Crispino is professor of history at Emory University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you
very much.
And we'd love to hear from all of you who live in Metro Atlanta. How much a factor was it to be close to public transportation when you moved in? Is MARTA access or Beltline access important? Would you pay more for it? Call us at 404-500-9457. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. 2016 is the centennial year of the Pulitzer Prize, and we'll spend some time this year with past winners who are connected to Georgia. It's a new series that we call Pulitzer Peaches. The first Southern newspaper to win the Pulitzer Prize for public service was the Columbus Inquirer Sun. It was 1926. That award recognizes the work of the paper's publishers, Julian and Julia Harris. They wrote about the Scopes Monkey Trial, and they also investigated Ku Klux Klan activities in local government. Greg Lisby joins me now. He's chair of the Communication Department at Georgia State University. Hi, Greg.
Good morning.
How did you get involved in studying Julian and Julia and their Pulitzer?
Well, it's an easy story. I grew up in Columbus, Georgia. My father was editor of the Columbus Ledger. I was a Ledger kid from way back. And the certificate for the Ledger's Pulitzer Prize was always on the newspaper walls. And one day my dad asked me, he says, did you realize that the Inquirer, the morning paper, also won the Pulitzer? And I did not. And I was right at that age of being in school and wanting to do some research. And I thought, what a great idea for a research project. And there it was.
Well, these two people, Julian and Julia Harris, were kind of characters in and of their own. I mean, Julian's dad, very famous, was Joel Chandler Harris, who wrote the Uncle Remus stories.
Yes.
And you say that Julian never quite escaped that shadow of his very famous dad.
Well, Julian himself provided that metaphor in his autobiography that he started and never finished. He talked about how the old adage was that sons never quite surpass the fame of their famous fathers. And the two examples he used were from history. One was Pliny the Elder and Pliny the Younger from the Roman Empire era. And the second was William Pitt the Elder and William Pitt the Younger from British history, both of whom served as prime ministers. And his point was that he didn't think, at least he understood it, that he would never quite reach that. And the other example, the other comparison point he was Henry Grady Jr. And so Henry Grady Jr.'s father was a famous journalist. Julian's father was a famous journalist. And the question was, would Julian ever surpass that? Julian himself acknowledged he spent most of his life trying. And yet, when he retired, the New York Times mentioned in its story about his retirement and subsequently in his obituary that, first off, he was the son of Joel Chandler Harris, and second, that he was an award-winning journalist.
So you have described this paper, the Columbus Inquirer Sun, as a working man's paper. What does that mean?
A working man's paper basically reminds us that in the 1920s, Columbus, Georgia really was not an overly progressive town. It was a mill town. Most of its workers worked in the mill. Some of them worked in Fort Benning, of course, but most of it was a very small Georgia cotton mill town. And so when you think about that, the audience for those types of publications were people who got up early, went to work much earlier, and so the Inquirer Sun really had a harder time aiming at that group. The Inquirer Sun also, because it was a morning paper, and this was just after World War I, where we find that the interesting news of Europe was 6 hours ahead, and so the Columbus Ledger had a better shot at getting the day's news from the war than the Inquirer did. And the Inquirer found itself in an uphill fight to get subscribers to follow its progressive line of thinking.
And when we talk about progressive, there was originally the coverage of the Scopes monkey trial. This is not news that they broke. There were lots of newspapers covering that. That was the trial in which they tried to fine and fire a teacher because he was teaching evolution. But the Columbus Inquirer Sun didn't really give a lot of credence to that anti-evolution position. That's fair, right?
That's fair. Not a bit of credence whatsoever. As a matter of fact, that particular fight was largely led by Julia. She was the one of the two of them who took more of an active role in what religion meant to them and what faith meant to her. And she was of the opinion that too many preachers from pulpits had uttered too many bigoted things, that she never really considered herself to be a church-going person. She considered herself to be religious and a faithful person, but not a church-going person. And that's what attracted her to the Scopes monkey trial because, again, at least history tells us that it was all sort of a much ado about nothing type of thing where John Scopes volunteered that he must have taught evolution at some point. And so, therefore, it's almost like he had to have been prosecuted. The ACLU had to step in and help defend him. And Henry Mencken had to be the defender, the defense attorney. And then William Jennings Bryan had to join the prosecution team. It was a big show. And it really was a fancy show. It was incredible. And you're correct, of course, that many newspapers were there. The Harrises were the only paper from Columbus represented, with the sole exception of one reporter from the Atlanta Georgian who did some feature pieces. But the Harrises went up there and stayed the entire time, and Julian wrote news, and Julia wrote commentary, and they just sort of flooded the local paper with it.
So that was one thing that the Pulitzer Committee mentioned into why they were getting the Public Service Award. I want to read what they said. For the service, in terms of what they're why they won the award, for the service which it rendered in its brave and energetic fight against the Ku Klux Klan, against the enactment of a law barring the teaching of evolution that would have been the Scopes Monkey Trial, and against dishonest and incompetent public officials, and for justice to the Negro and against lynching, which was the lynching coverage was in some ways connected to their coverage of the Ku Klux Klan.
Certainly it was.
Yeah, so let's talk about the KKK and how they landed on that story.
Well, by the way, the KKK story, part of this, had actually mostly taken place prior to the year for which they are acknowledged for the Pulitzer Prize. The 1926 Pulitzer Prize is given for activities in 1925. And in 1925, the Harrises didn't do all that much. When the Harrises came to Columbus in 1920, they and Thomas Loyalist, who was the co-owner of the paper at the time, they were all over the Klan. They took the Klan to task every time, every chance they had. But by about 1924, after the newspaper revealed that the governor, Governor Walker, who was the
mayor of Atlanta, William Walker, yeah.
Yes, who gave a speech at the Klan convention, once they revealed that and once he sort of forced other state government officials to acknowledge that they were also Klansmen.
So this is a really interesting story because it sounds like they followed him maybe. He said he was going to something and he really was going to this Ku Klux Klan convention. Did they follow him?
No. They used the newspaper close by. They used the Kansas City newspaper to investigate, you know, and then the Kansas City newspaper gave, they couldn't get in, of course, but they gave the speech, and the speech used the phrase that that the governor was very well known for using. And so they then went to the governor's appointment secretary to find out where he had been, and it turned out he had not been in Pennsylvania, that he had not been where he said he was, and they just traveled, they tracked his travels.
And it became so scandalous that he actually named a whole bunch of other
yes.
public officials in order to take the attention off himself.
It sure was, exactly. Exactly.
So it blew up. Okay, we are speaking with Greg Lisby. He is the chair of the communication department at Georgia State University, and we're talking about the first Pulitzer Prize for public service that was given to the Columbus Inquirer Sun in 1926. Let's bring in someone who can explain about that particular prize, the one for public service. Jennifer Barry Hawes recently wrote about this for the Columbia Journalism Review. She is a watchdog and public service reporter at the Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi there, Jennifer.
Good morning.
So the Pulitzer Committee gives 14 prizes every year for journalism. What makes this Public Service Award different, Jennifer?
Well, the Public Service Prize is really, among journalists, considered to be the sort of the top prize. And I think it's because that the idea of public service is so central to what we do and it's central to what we should be doing that it's elevated in that regard. And I think that the prizes throughout history, and particularly regarding the KKK coverage, the Pulitzer Board has used those prizes, I think, to really give journalists a sense of what they should be doing and what real public service looks like. And the other prizes also being important, of course, but I think that element of public service is just so central to everything that we should be doing that it kind of sits on the top of the heap.
Now, this is not the first. 1926 was not the first time a Pulitzer had gone to a paper for its coverage of the KKK. A paper in Memphis got it earlier, mm-hmm. and it was not the last either. Why did the Pulitzer Committee focus so much attention on coverage and investigation of the KKK?
Well, I thought it was interesting. I did not realize myself until I worked on that story that, in fact, the board awarded four gold medals for public service alone in the 1920s, which was really the first full decade the prizes were given. So if you imagine four selections on any topic would be pretty incredible. And so the fact that they gave them to the KKK coverage, I think, is significant. The one interesting point I might add is that the first of those was given in 1922 to the New York World, which was a Joseph Pulitzer newspaper. The World ran a huge, I think it was a 21-day expose on the Klan that then ran in newspapers across the country. Not as many in the South, but really did elevate the Klan to Klan coverage to a certain level. I think most people didn't realize it had been enjoying such a resurgence and inflicting a lot of harm in communities where it had taken hold. The four that were given at the time, Memphis also received one. Columbus received one, and then the other one was the Indianapolis Times, which obviously was the northern newspaper. But the emphasis on KKK coverage, I think, was a way for the board to show what Joseph Pulitzer's ideals really were and what he wanted to see coming out of journalists and what he wanted to see become really foundational to what we were doing. Because if you think about it, back in the 20s, there really was not a sense of journalism as a public service enterprise.
Yeah, it was the era of yellow journalism.
Mm-hmm. And Pulitzer himself had been obviously very involved in yellow journalism as he engaged in his battles with William Randolph Hearst. And I think that when he created the prizes, he really wanted to get away from that. He wanted to leave a legacy that went beyond his notoriety as a yellow journalist.
Yellow journalism is biased journalism meant to sway public opinion or bring about policy. Greg, one of the things that Jennifer writes about is how people that were covering the KKK, that ended up resulting in a lot of personal sacrifice. It was an act of bravery to do so. And although they were very proud of the award, Julian and Julia Harris did not reap a huge number of benefits from winning the Pulitzer, correct?
Well, they did not receive increased circulation. The circulation was, one of the writers described it as a kaleidoscope. It went up and down and up and down. Their notoriety was great in the North, but it was terrible in the South. They were hated by large measures of Southern readers and other Southern editors at that particular time. They also were having money trouble because they couldn't get advertising, they couldn't get circulation. And there's a letter that I thought was really an interesting one where someone wrote them congratulating them on the Pulitzer Prize, but said that instead of the gold medal, that they wished they had attached a $2,000 check for Julian. That would have helped some, because finally they did have to sell the newspaper in 1929.
Did the notoriety that Greg mentioned of the Pulitzer help the other papers that won this particular award?
Not in those early days. Back then, the prizes were really a very new and somewhat unknown commodity, so I don't think that it provided much strength or benefit to those papers right away. I think that was something that built over time, so that today, obviously, it does. But back then, the prizes didn't carry the kind of weight that they carry today. And unfortunately, as you mentioned earlier, the KKK coverage had such a negative effect on circulation and other issues with these newspapers that it was really a net loss in that regard. Obviously, it was a tremendous gain for the public good, but for those newspaper publishers in particular, they did this at tremendous financial risk and personal risk as well. I think it's worth noting that they really put themselves in positions of potential physical harm. And in fact, one of the newspapers in the 50s that won, that editor, or publisher rather, I think he received something like 1,000 death threats. And his son was asking him, is the Klan going to kill you, Daddy? And those sorts of things that I think, while the financial risks were great, it obviously takes a certain degree of courage to come out in a community where you know the power structure is infiltrated by people who are going to be very angry about what you're writing.
So the Pulitzer, although, as you mentioned, they had a banner of it in the newspaper at the Columbus Sun, Inquirer Sun.
A certificate on the wall, yes.
Oh, they had the certificate on the wall.
Yes.
Did Julia and Julian continue to think of that as a good thing? Or they eventually had to sell out, and you talked about his retirement.
Well, basically, someone asked Julia that question after her husband had died, and her response was that she felt like it only encouraged their enemies, and that all in all, she did not see a great benefit to come out of that. But again, you need to realize that she comes at it from the standpoint of someone who is fighting equally alongside her husband, and has fought a losing battle at that time. In hindsight, of course, we look back and we say, what a great couple, what a great crusade they engaged in. And yet at that time, Columbus was not happy with them. He should have had the great opportunity to be the perfect Southern journalist, because his father was the perfect entree into Southern journalism. And he was not. He was hated.
So before we wrap up this conversation, Jennifer, the papers that won, especially for KKK coverage, they were largely Southern newspapers, right?
Well, early on it was about 50-50, because it was New York and Indianapolis, and then also Memphis and Columbus, Georgia. later in the 50s, there was a shared prize between two newspapers that sat on either side of the North Carolina-South Carolina border. But prior to that, in the 20s, it was 50-50.
So did it accomplish what Pulitzer wanted it to accomplish? Did it encourage more investigative journalism?
Oh, I think so. In fact, when Pulitzer retired from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, he gave a retirement speech that really sums up that was a century ago, what we today as journalists really consider the core of what we do. He talked about things like not tolerating injustice or corruption, never lacking sympathy for the poor, never being afraid to attack wrong. I really emphasized challenging the power structures in your communities,
yeah.
And we look at that today, a century later. So I feel like
the goal was
accomplished. Mm-hmm.
Jennifer Berry Hawes is watchdog and public service reporter at the Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina. And Greg Lisby is chair of the communication department at Georgia State University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This conversation is part of Pulitzer Peaches. It's a series that celebrates 100 years of the Pulitzer Prizes and winners from Georgia. You can catch the entire series at gpbnews.org. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. The Stewart Detention Facility in Lumpkin, Georgia, processes thousands of immigrants and refugees every year. More than 97% of these people are eventually deported back to their country of origin. That process can be heartbreaking for both the detainees and their families. But many of them have found comfort with the help of Amilcar Valencia. He's the director of El Refugio Ministries.
We have a small house. The house is just a mile from the detention center. So the families can come to our house either before or after the visit. We're open during the weekend. We offer meals. We offer some comfort, some friendship to the families who, are going to this rough moment of their life to have, a loved one in detention.
Amilcar and his group of volunteers spend almost every weekend of the year at El Refugio. They stay busy even when the center has no guests.
We also visit the people who are in detention. So that's another service that we do. We bring groups to the facility to visit with detaining immigrants who might have or not have families in the United States. And for many of them, our visitors, our volunteers, are the only people that they have received visits from.
Amilcar says the people who stay at El Refugio are often distracted and grieving and in need of comfort.
These are people who are going through difficult moments of having a father, husband, son, or a friend detained. This woman, her father was deported. Then her husband was detained, and she came again to visit him. And he was deported, too. And now, recently, her brother was also detained and was deported, too. So she's been through so many rough times, her father, her husband, and her brother being detained and deported.
El Refugio has helped many people enjoy the time they have with loved ones before they're sent out of the country. We reached out to one of those guests.
My name is Hannah Yusun Cho, and I am currently residing in Atlanta, Georgia, and I came from South Korea 21 years ago.
Hannah traveled to Lumpkin, Georgia last year to visit her boyfriend at the Stewart Detention Facility. They stopped by El Refugio and were welcomed with open arms.
They cleared out the dining room and they set up a bed so that we could sleep there. And they were very welcoming and extremely kind to us. We got to talk to the hosts a lot, and we just asked them like little stuff. Like normally our conversations would be like, it would touch on the subject of why we were there and who we were visiting, but we got to connect with them and it was really great. We got to know them as people.
For Hannah, having a welcoming place to stay made a world of difference.
It was a godsend because people go there on Saturday and they also visit on Sunday because they stay the night. And that way we're able to have 2 hours of visitation because technically visitation starts over on Sunday, which is the first day of the week to them. We've met people who came down from New York, from South Carolina, North Carolina, someone flew in from California even.
Hannah's boyfriend eventually lost his legal battle. He was deported last August. And although the pain is still sharp, Hannah still remembers the kindness she received at El Refugio.
They fed us. They gave us all the utilities that we needed. And that it meant a lot to all of us, really, like, because we were all in the same spot. And it was, the people there were wonderful. They were just really wonderful.
Amilcar Valencia has been the director of El Refugio for 6 years. He says he hopes the center's work will eventually inspire change.
There is no hotels. There is just one park, and there is two restaurants, and that's it. So for us, the service is not just, you know, offer the place to stay, which is great, you know, for the community who come to visit their loved ones, but also an opportunity for Americans to see what detention center looks like and what immigrants are going through. And hopefully they get, you know, more engaged in these issues.
For more on El Refugio, visit gpbnews.org. UNICEF reports that more than 80% of children in Syria have been harmed by the unrest in that country. Georgia just might welcome many more families with kids as the U.S. plans to take in as many as 100,000 refugees by next year. Last March, producer Sean Powers visited one family that now calls Georgia home.
A Syrian family who moved to Decatur, Georgia about a month ago is gathered in their apartment around a game of Jenga. They've asked us not to use their last name because of safety concerns. In the room, there's the father, Taha, his wife, Hayad, and their three children. You got 16-year-old Rhonda, 14-year-old Alan, and 10-year-old Nowruz. Their youngest, Nowruz, concentrates on the game as she prepares to make a move.
No.
Yes.
You want to do it again?
Yes.
Okay.
Bee Win helps refugees transition to life in the U.S. She says she sees parallels between experiences of Syrian refugees today and that of her own relatives who arrived in the U.S. in the late 1970s from Vietnam.
When our governor was not welcoming, and there's that rhetoric that we hear nationally, it really pulled on my heartstrings.
She's talking about last year when Georgia Governor Nathan Deal joined other Republican governors by saying he wouldn't accept Syrian refugees in this state following the deadly Paris attacks. The governor later rescinded that order. The family's long journey began when their town in Syria was captured by ISIS militants. 56-year-old Taha, the father, describes what happened.
We were in a village near the city of Kamashli. We were about 60 to 70 families. The Islamic State took over our village. They killed my cousin in front of my eyes. My neighbor got killed and saw others too, about 5 or 6 people. We ran away. They caught most of us for 24 hours, then they let us out.
His family fled from Syria to Turkey. After a couple of years, they arrived in the U.S. Even though the family is now in Georgia, the trauma of conflict is still fresh. In the kitchen, I ask Rhonda and her sister Nowruz to tell me what they remember about Syria. Rhonda describes what she misses the most.
My home, my school, my park.
Do you want to go back to Syria, though?
If Syria is not good, we don't go. If Syria is good, we want to go.
Okay. Is Syria not good right now?
Yes, not good.
Why? What about it is not good? Rhonda uses her hands as a gun and imitates the sound of gunfire.
Like this. Yes.
At the dinner table, the family sits together with new friends, far away from the violence. There is a large traditional Kurdish feast that includes homemade yogurt, baked chicken, and kidney beans.
That's all that matters to us is company rather than
The family is at ease right now, but there is something bothering Taha. He says he can't do manual labor because he hurt his arm, leg, and back before coming to the U.S. He's still looking for work while he and his wife try to learn English. But still, J.D. McCrary of the International Rescue Committee in Atlanta says the family's prospects in Georgia are good.
Between 80 and 90% of all newly arriving refugee households are at 6 months, 180 days, are self-sufficient, which means that they have gone from carrying, having no other earthly belongings than what they're able to get off the luggage cart at the airport, to having at least one person in the household employed paying their own way.
He says the reason the self-sufficiency rate is better here compared to other states is because of the diversity of entry-level jobs.
Which means that they have gone from having no other earthly belongings than what they're able to get off the luggage cart to having at least one person in the household employed paying their own way.
New Beginnings is an appropriate theme this month with the start of the Kurdish New Year. It's called Nowruz, the same name as the youngest member of the family in Decatur. The word translates to new day. For GPB News, I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
Did you come to Georgia as a refugee? And how do you maintain that sense of your home? Join our conversation now. It's at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. My next guest is a self-proclaimed redneck. She's also a championship baker who watched her mother and grandmothers whip up Southern suppers in the kitchen every Sunday. Francine Bryson takes those classic recipes and makes them her own in her new cookbook, Country Cooking from a Redneck Kitchen. I spoke with her last month, and I started off with a question about her decision to use the word redneck.
Well, yeah, I know. I get this everywhere. The cool thing about it is Jeff Foxworthy is actually the one that started calling me redneck on national TV, and it stuck. So I said, hey, if he can do it and get away with it, we're going to stick with it. But honest and truly, the word redneck comes from years and years ago when the farmers would be out working in the fields. The back of their necks get sunburnt, so they called them rednecks. And it's nothing derogatory or demeaning. It was actually hardcore people that lived off the land. And it's we still do that. I still grow my own vegetables and raise my own chickens and eat my own eggs and all that. So it's a good thing for me, to me. And, you know, I hate that people are small-minded to where they think it's a derogatory statement.
One of the things I love about this cookbook, it's just so unfamiliar to me. I mean, there's stuff in here. There's a cheeseburger pie.
Right.
There's squirrel in here,
yeah.
Which you admit is not for everybody.
Exactly. But they only let me put one wild game in there. I was like, oh, I want to put deer, and I want to put the squirrel, and I want to put rabbit. And they're like, no, you're not doing all that. And I said, at least let me have one. So I figured squirrel was the less evasive for everybody. But you can substitute chicken if you want to.
And you said they taste like chicken.
Well, they kind of do taste like chicken. But they, to me, and a lot of people, I don't know if people will agree or disagree, but to me, squirrel tastes like a non-greasy duck. It's real lean. It's real rich. It's not full of fat. It's not greasy. But it's just, it has a really good flavor to it. It just takes a whole bunch of them to make a meal because they're tiny. So,
how do you go about, when you're writing down these recipes, and it mm-hmm. sounds like some of them have been passed down.
Oh, yeah.
How do you go about making sure you've written them in a way that an inexperienced cook could make them? You know what I mean? Because you mean,
right.
You're so practiced in the kitchen, there must be
right.
things that you do without even thinking.
I actually, and that's one of the hardest things is coming up with the measurements, because a lot of the recipes that are passed down, there's no measurements. It just
yeah.
says a dash of salt or a dash of this or a dash of that. And learning to cook with measurement spoons and measurement cups is one of the hardest things for me to adapt to. But writing the recipes, even the ones that have been passed down, I actually have to do the recipe, measure it, and write it down. I have a laptop sitting in my kitchen, and I'm typing as I'm measuring and making. So that was the best thing my husband ever did is he says, here's a laptop for your kitchen. And it's
and
red,
it
just like
there.
The kitchen. It stays in there.
Do you have to put plastic over it to keep flour
no,
from getting into
no,
the keys?
I have it on the island, and I work on my counter. So I have it. I'll turn around and type and everything, but I keep a can of that spray stuff.
Oh, yeah.
The air. I spray it like 15 times a day.
I wanted to ask a little bit about Southern cooking in general, because
right.
we've seen some real changes in
yes.
in how would you describe our evolution on the views of Southern cooking?
Well, a lot of people, they read this book and they go, oh, look at the food she's eating. We don't eat this every day. We don't eat
very
heavy,
rich
foods every day. We eat a lot of salads, and especially in the summertime in the South. It's hot down here. We're not, you know, cranking the stove and oven. I mean, it's Sunday. It's when you're eating your heavy foods and things like that, or making something for family gatherings, or casseroles for there's a funeral, or, you know, somebody's having a party or something like that. But I think Southern food is now trendy. You can get it everywhere. I'm proud of that. I'm proud that the rest of the country is seeing what we've always known. And I think it's really great that people have adapted to Southern food. I like it lightened up. I like grilled a lot. We do a lot of grilling in the summertime because I'm baking. I'm already heating my house up. I'm not putting a cast iron pan on top of the stove and heating it up even worse. But I think it's in the evolution of Southern food. And the lighting of Southern food, I think it's awesome. I mean,
lightening, you mean taking out some of the fat and calories.
Right, taking out the fat. In fact, my next book is, I'm doing gluten-free, I'm doing sugar-free, I'm doing lightened up recipes. I've got a whole chapter. I'm working on a whole chapter. It's got like 40 salad recipes. So, I mean, I don't eat like that all the time. I mean, but I love my pork chops. I love my cube steak. I love my gravy. I like it on my fries. But, I mean, we don't, it's not an everyday thing. But the recipes are so adaptable in this book, and I've simplified them so much to where if there's something in there you don't like, take it out. The pork chops will work without gravy. The casserole will work without gravy. You can change it up to be whatever you want it to be.
So, if I could have you explain, there's a lot of the tone, your voice comes through so clearly in this book, which is not true of every cookbook. So that's a lovely thing. But help me understand what dinner on the ground is.
Dinner?
Because as soon as I heard that, I thought it meant a picnic, like on a.
It kind of does. It kind of does. But us being raised, I was raised half Baptist, half Church of God. So dinner on the ground for us is that one Sunday in the month where the preacher says, okay, next Sunday we're having dinner on the ground. Everybody brings their potluck favorite and there's like 30 different fried chickens and 20 green beans. And, you know, everybody loves grandma's macaroni and cheese. So everybody brings their potluck meal. You get your food and you sit at picnic tables or on blankets or on, you know, tablecloths you set. And you literally would sit on the ground and have dinner on the ground. And that's where it come from. But it also means picnic. It also means, you know, throw a sandwich in a basket and go off and spend the afternoon out in a park somewhere. And it's just let life happen around you. Just calm down, take a few minutes, and take it all in.
My guest is National Pie Champion and Competitive Cook, Francine Bryson. She's author of Country Cooking from a Redneck Kitchen. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today, but I always love to hear from you. So, what do you whip up in the kitchen when you want something quick and satisfying and you don't care if it's healthy or not? Peanut butter and marshmallow fluff sandwich? Mac and cheese with hot dogs? What is your guilty pleasure in the kitchen? Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us. We're at OST Talk or post on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.